Good afternoon. You are listening to Rochester Indie Media. My name is Ted Forsyth. On April 19, 2013, I interviewed Kathy Kelly, a co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, which is a campaign to end United States military and economic warfare. The website is vcnc.org. That's V as in Victor, C as in Creative, N as in Nancy, and V as in Victor.org. Kathy has lived in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Yemen, and her role in the Convergence is to relay those experiences and give a human voice to the lived reality of people overseas who deal with drone surveillance and are murdered by drone attacks on a daily basis. Kathy and many others will be attending Resisting Drones, Global War, and Empire, a Convergence being held in Syracuse, New York from April 26th to 28th. You can find out more about the Convergence at upstatedroneaction, all one word, .org. In this interview, Kathy and I spoke about her role in Voices for Creative Nonviolence, her travels abroad where she met individuals and families hurt by drone warfare, the connections between the military-industrial complex and the prison-industrial complex, and her entry into the anti-war movement, among other topics.
My name is Kathy Kelly. I'm a co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, a campaign to end United States military and economic warfare.
And could you tell me a little bit how you got to this point in your life?
Sure. You know, I was somebody who had always wanted to make a difference in my own neighborhood. I was living in what was the poorest neighborhood on the north side of Chicago back in the 1970s. And most of my neighbors were people who lived in abandoned buildings, went to the soup kitchens for their meals. And I was fortunate to be part of a community that was, you know, trying to make it a little easier for our own neighbors. And most of us were employed as teachers or social workers or nurses. But it began to be just not enough to serve up hot soup or take a shift overnight at the local shelter and keep a house of hospitality going, because we could see that so much money was being poured into military spending at the height of the Cold War, maintaining nuclear weapons and all manner of other weapons, and the teenagers in our own neighborhood couldn't survive their teenage years. So we decided to try to take a stronger step, and it was in a very positive kind of protest against the nuclear weapon buildup. We planted corn on top of nuclear missile silos in the Midwest, and that landed me in prison for 1 year, maximum security. And I suppose in some ways maybe I came out with of prison with a little more backbone, a little stronger in many ways. And so I then, when we learned about the United States preparing to go to war against Iraq, asked the peace team if I could join them. It was mostly a European organized effort. And so I spent the first war against Iraq, the Desert Storm War, in Iraq in a peace camp on the border between Saudi Arabia and Iraq, and eventually traveled along roads that were being heavily bombed, trying to bring medical relief supplies to civilians who had committed no crime, certainly couldn't control the dictator of their country. And then from that, we developed an effort to break the economic sanctions that were directly targeting and harming children, elderly people, poor people, but most severely the children. So I spent the next war, the shock and awe bombing in Baghdad, with a peace team, the Iraq peace team. And since that time, we felt that it's important to try to be in touch with 21st century military wars, which are now being waged in a way that's different. It's very reliant on drone warfare, drone technology, the unmanned aerial vehicles, and also on working in conjunction with the special operations forces. These are the Rangers, the Navy SEALs, Green Berets, special operations forces in the country that's being attacked, such as Afghanistan, and then also the CIA. And so there's kind of a blurness, they might want to say a jointness, but one writer, Nick Turse, says there's a blurness, a blurring of the borders between these different military groups, but they come together to wage very overwhelming and menacing warfare that targets civilians every single day. And we're trying to understand this from the point of view of the civilians who have nowhere to run and nowhere to hide. Mm-hmm. And that's why we go back and forth to Afghanistan so often.
Can you tell me a little bit about how you got into demonstrating against and raising awareness about drone warfare?
Well, I would actually attribute it to a very good friend named Jeremy Scahill. He's just come out with a book called Dirty Wars. And prior to that, he was gaining lots of notoriety for a book about Blackwater. These are the security contractors. Now they're called Akademi in Afghanistan. And they do a lot of the jobs that the military once did, but they're paid very handsomely. They're a high-end security contractors firm. And Jeremy was exploring information about this group of security contractors and learning a lot about the 21st century military. And he was kind of pounding our kitchen table saying, when are you going to get in touch with the 21st century military and start being able to speak credibly about that? And so we started just going online and learning a lot about the Reaper drone and the mm-hmm. Predator drone, these unmanned aerial vehicles that at the time were being operated out of Creech Air Force Base primarily. And so we went out to Creech Air Force Base and we did a visual outside the base. We tried to be in touch with people inside the base. Mm-hmm. We let them know that we were concerned for them as well. You know, there's a lot of stress that is involved. If you're basically 18 inches away from the war zone, even though you're 8,000 miles away, you're very close to what's going on, tracking and monitoring people. And when you're given the order, impact, you know, to let Hellfire missiles shoot from a plane that you're manipulating, mm-hmm. and on your screen you see body parts flying and, you know, clumps of blood and blood, and then you look at the clock and, oh gosh, it's time to go pick up my kid at the soccer field. There's quite a cognitive dissonance there as well. And we, again, want to always try to understand what's happening from the point of view of the people who can't escape from these war zones. And I'm sure many military people feel trapped in these jobs as well. Mm-hmm. So we entered onto the base with a letter that we wanted to deliver to the commander, and we were immediately arrested and we were eventually tried. And the judge listened to expert witness testimony from Anne Wright, mm-hmm. Former diplomat and colonel in the Army, and Ramsey Clark, former U.S. Attorney General, and Bill Quigley, head at the time of the Center for Constitutional Rights. And at the end of the trial, the judge was so involved in it all, he said, you know, I need 4 months to think about this. He didn't give a verdict. He took 4 months, and then he did find us guilty. But he gave us time to serve for the time that we had spent in the county jail awaiting the first indictment. So we began to realize that this issue needed coverage, that so many people, even within the judicial branch of the United States government, knew very little about it and wanted to know more. And that's why people have been engaging in civil disobedience now, not only at Creech Air Force Base, but also at the Air National Guard Base outside of the Hancock International Airport in Syracuse, mm-hmm. Volk Field in Wisconsin. People are paying attention now to White Men Air Force Base, where one of our colleagues is now serving a 6-month prison sentence for having done the same thing. Mm-hmm. Brian Terrell tried to deliver a letter, and he was convicted on federal charges of trespass to a military installation. All he did was just walk across the line. A bunch of us were there. We were right behind him. We didn't cross the line, and Brian did. He went to 6 months in prison.
Wow. What would you say are like the main issues that people don't understand about drone warfare?
Well, I think the main word to emphasize is proliferation. You know, in 1945, only one country had the nuclear bomb, the United States. Mm-hmm. And now look at our world. You know, Israel alone has 200 to 400 thermonuclear weapons. Pakistan has nuclear weapons. China, many countries all around the world who are in various kinds of competition with one another, have nuclear weapons. And, you know, we could end up with a nuclear holocaust. Well, it's very easy, imperatively to create an unmanned aerial vehicle that might carry a dirty bomb, that might carry a bomb with nuclear capacity. The United States is now selling the technology to various countries, but Israel is selling drones to China. China is selling them to Pakistan. We've really created a world full of potential enmity, and then, of course, people are going to want to say, well, now we need protection. Mm-hmm. And it costs enormous, enormous sums of money. And meanwhile, the people who can hear drones flying overhead, sometimes you can't hear them, but sometimes you can, are, you know, lying stiff as a board trying to fall asleep at night, wondering if they'll be the next target, if their children might be killed in Yemen, in Somalia, in Pakistan, in Afghanistan. And this creates rage if people decide that they're going to fight back.
Well, that's a great segue into my next question, which is basically, what does resistance to the war machine look like? Do you think it's possible to abolish the war machine?
Well, I think that many people think they can't voice their opinions or stand up against the military-industrial complex because jobs will go missing and people will become unemployed. Or if you sometimes think about universities, they're afraid that they might lose a defense contract. Or if you think about faith-based communities, people are afraid that they might alienate people in the pews that are involved in the military. And so I think there's a sort of a quietude that settles in. And even though people might be uneasy about so much of our wealth and resource and ingenuity being poured into the military, while we can't deal with economic problems in our own neighborhoods or with climate change, that people are afraid to speak up. But I think if people begin to understand that actually the military doesn't create jobs, they don't really support the economy, that we could take the same amount of money that's put into the military and invest that in maybe building mass transit systems or retrofitting the housing stock so that it was more energy efficient, or taking care of our elders or child care, that we would be creating 4,000 more jobs per sum of money than we are creating when we invest the money in the military. And that we could be also enhancing our own security, because we wouldn't be making things that blow people up and kill people. We'd be making things that are good for people. Mm-hmm. And we wouldn't be making enemies all around the world. We could be beloved all around the world if we were taking the money. For instance, it takes $800,000 to keep one person locked up in Guantanamo for 1 year. It costs $1 million to keep one U.S. soldier in Afghanistan for 1 year, $2 billion to keep the U.S. military presence in Afghanistan for 1 week. Mm-hmm. So take those sums of money and think about things we could do that would create far better relationships between the United States and people living in a very, very needy world.
Hmm. You've been to jail before, and I'm wondering if... I'm going to switch gears in here a minute. If you have any thoughts or comments on the connectivity, the interconnectivity between the military-industrial complex and the prison-industrial complex.
Now, that's a very, very important question. I think the other place where so many people sense that their jobs are connected is the security-industrial complex, both in the prison building, the prison expansion, the prison franchise development, the numbers of lawyers whose jobs are dependent on the criminal justice system, and, you know, the resources to keep the criminal justice system people employed are more prisoners, and then you bring in the war on drugs.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it has constituted a war against impoverished people, and had it not been for the mass incarceration trend of the last decade, there would be 20% less poverty in this country, according to a recent New York Times article in February of 2013. So that's something certainly to look at. The way in which the criminal behavior that really threatens people in the United States is involved in creation of firearms, in creation of more and more weapon systems, in creation of pollution that lowers our health and our our chance for longevity, really. Mm-hmm. The other thing that creates many deaths all across the United States is driving under the influence. And mm-hmm. so the manufacture of alcohol, firearms, tobacco, pollution, and weapons, these are things which threaten life in the United States and all around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't say that any of the people that are chief executive officers of companies that are involved in this kind of productivity should go to jail. I'd like to see some rehabilitated, but I don't want to lock them up. But how terrible to round up the people who've had the least benefit from our systems, the people whose education has been terrible,
mm-hmm.
the people who haven't had access to health care or even nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
And then as teenagers, they're very vulnerable trying to get some money to becoming involved in the only industry going on in their neighborhood, and that's the drug trade.
Mm-hmm.
And then we take them into the prisons and keep them there for decades. The last time I was in prison, it was a minimum security prison called Pekin Prison.
Mm-hmm.
But across the road from us was a medium to high security prison. And when the bus would pull up to that prison, young men, manacled and shackled, would stumble off that bus, and the median sentence amongst those young men was 27 years.
Wow.
The median sentence. So they would be in prison for 50 years. They'd be grandfathers before they'd get out, many of them. What sense does this make? And meanwhile, you've got other young people who are impoverished and poorly educated. They don't know what to do with their lives, and they join the military. And they go over to other countries. And do you know now the leading cause of death amongst combat veterans is suicide?
Mm-hmm.
There are 1,000 attempts every month made by combat veterans to take their own lives.
I raise that briefly because, not only because you said you were in prison, but recently I read a blog post by Jalil Montekim, who's a Black Panther and political prisoner in Attica, and I went and visited him a few weeks ago. And he wrote a piece about drone warfare and COINTELPRO, and the murder of Fred Hampton, for instance, was a secret, you know, government operation. And so he was questioning, like, if we're not skeptical about drones, these potential assassin machines could start killing people in the United States, and it could just be a whole other sort of, you know, option available to the planners for whatever they need. And it was just an interesting synthesis of these two issues. But thank you for your answer.
It might sound so otherworldly almost, but I just came back from Gaza 3 months ago. I'd been there 2 days after a ceasefire was signed following an 8-day Arab attack by the Israeli Defense Forces, in which they really pounded civilian neighborhoods with hellfire missiles and 500-pound bombs and other kinds of weapons. But prior to that, the Israelis routinely will target somebody for assassination, and the person might be driving along in a car, and bang, you know, a hellfire missile blows up the car. And the United States does this in countries like Yemen, Somalia, Pakistan, and Afghanistan, after President Obama gets together for a Tuesday morning meeting during which they decide who the high-value targets for that week will be.
Right.
And that's their list of people they're going to assassinate. So it's being done in other countries, and I can understand why people are starting to wonder, well, is that going to start happening here? What if you scare the populace so much into thinking, look, we either get rid of that bad guy or they might get rid of you,
mm-hmm.
and so therefore tolerate, accept that we're going to use airborne attacks. Well, it takes away completely any discussion of a jury, trial by a jury of your peers, interrogation isn't even needed. Some say, well, then you don't need to Guantanamo, you know, you just kill the people, don't bother locking them up.
Right.
Well, this is a very frightening future that we're holding out for ourselves, and we certainly should be involved, all of us, in the discussion of this. But instead, a lot of this is undertaken by the CIA, and we don't have any chance to discuss because they don't have to disclose their tactics or what they're doing.
Right. Yeah, actually, I did an interview this morning with Anne Wright, and we were talking, and I just had, as she was talking, this question came to me, but it was, first of all, should we be concerned that other countries are starting to get drones and use them in the same way? And if we should be worried, you know, like, what are the possible ramifications of that, you know? She had mentioned, like, basically if, like, another country got a drone program, it could potentially, you know, fly maybe in our skies, you know what I mean? Like, because we certainly don't care about sovereignty of airspace, you know? I'm wondering, like, do you have any thoughts on that, like, just other countries getting drone programs?
Well, certainly this proliferation of the potential to have drone warfare is not very respectful of borders, and so we have reason to wonder if other countries or not state agencies might at some point be able to decide we can assassinate people whom we feel are a threat mm-hmm. to us. And it's curious to me that there's not more discussion going on all across the country. However, we are starting to notice that major newspapers are beginning to raise some of these questions and also some of the universities. So this is something all of us should be pressuring for, to have discussion about drones. The Senate Judicial Committee with Senator Durbin is going to be discussing drones during the coming week. And this is something that gives people an opportunity to get in touch with their elected representatives and say, we want you to chime in on that discussion and represent our views.
So this upcoming next weekend, April 26th or 28th, there's going to be a conference called Resisting Drones, Global War and Empire, and it's in Syracuse, New York. And to my knowledge, you're going to be there.
I so look forward to it. I mean, I think the people in Syracuse have been great through the Upstate Ground the Drones Coalition in bringing these issues to the court of public opinion. And they've done it by drawing attention to the drone warfare that's being operated right out of Hancock Field, which is in Syracuse.
So I guess my question is, I have a few questions, but one of them is, what's your role at the Convergence, and are you presenting anything at the Convergence?
Well, I think my role is to try to give a voice to some of the human beings, people not so unlike ourselves, you know, but living in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, whom I've had a chance to meet with, and to talk with the people who gather about what it has been like for instance, a young woman named Fasuma. Her husband was a student, and he and four other students were in a garden. They were sipping tea. They were on a break from classes. And all of a sudden, a Hellfire missile was fired by a drone flying overhead. Their bodies were dismembered, torn apart, and all five were killed. Oh. And so I'll talk about how Fasula feels about that, and also how her mother-in-law feels. Her mother-in-law is just in a rage still, and I don't blame her. She said, you know, nobody gives them any answers. They ask, why did you kill my son? Why did you kill these young students? And the answer has been, well, there were doubts, there were suspicions. She's, you know, smart enough to know that you shouldn't cold-bloodedly murder somebody on a suspicion or on a doubt. This was her son. Mm-hmm. This was Anna's father, the young five-year-old child who's now bereft, and Fazila and the mother don't have any way of getting an income. And so they're worried that the child will starve. Mm-hmm. These are questions that aren't asked by the drone operators, by the kill team that gives the orders, by President Obama and his group of advisors on the Tuesday morning conference call. Mm-hmm. And I also want to talk about a man, Safdar Dawar. He was with the Tribal League of Journalists in North Waziristan. And we had a chance to talk with him when Josh Boyer and I were in Islamabad in Pakistan. And he said, I have a question for you. He asked us, do people in your country know about this usage of drones against civilian populations? And I said, well, I think in the universities, people are starting to talk about it. And this was several years ago.
Yeah.
And he said, that's not what I'm asking you. I'm asking you, on the evening news, ordinary people just, you know, watching the news at night, mm-hmm. do they see this? And I said, no, I'm afraid they don't. And then he asked me, where is your democracy? Where is your democracy? You know, democracy is based on education. Mm-hmm. And if our people aren't educated, then how can they make informed decisions?
Right, absolutely. Why should people come out to the conversions next weekend? What are they going to get when they go there?
Well, you know, I've noticed that grandparents love their grandchildren. You notice that? I mean, they just love them. And, of course, parents love their children. Mm-hmm. And I think that people want to help the children in their lives, then they have to help see what kind of a world we're steering into. We can't fly blind. And we certainly can't expect the six-year-olds to sort it out.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of tough thinking that we need to do to better understand the role of the United States and the United States people in a globalized world where, you know, we're 6% mm-hmm. of the world's population. The other 94% of the people in this world include many people who are frightened of the United States
mm-hmm.
and who want protection from the United States. And there are loads of weapons and armaments and weapon systems and proliferating and newly developing weapon systems. What kind of a world do we want for our future? And, you know, can we really afford to be spending $2 billion per week on war in Afghanistan when we can't deal with the consequences of climate change, the greatest threats to future generations here at home? So come out. People should come out from Rochester, from even as far away as Buffalo, from Ithaca, from neighborhoods in Syracuse, and better understand the kind of world we're facing. And then we can sort things out together and catch courage from one another, which always happens, and really get to know some of these extremely fine activists who fill the courtrooms and fill the county jail in Syracuse on a regular basis, trying to bring their grievance. You know, Congress shall make no law to abridge the right of people to assemble peaceably for redress of grievance. They go mm-hmm. very peaceably to the perimeters of the drone warfare encampment that the military has created at Hancock Field. And then they're handcuffed, and then they're stuck in county jails. But they bring their grievance before the courts and before the court of public opinion. And it's great to get to know these people. They're some of the finest people in the world, and they'll all be there.
Is there anything else you'd like to say right now that I haven't asked you about?
Well, I hope people will also stay in touch with Voices for Creative Nonviolence. There's a team of four people who are educators and activists in the Chicago area in Afghanistan right now, and we're looking forward to their reports. I'll leave from Syracuse to go over to Afghanistan, and I'll try my best to listen carefully and write reports that will be posted on our website and sometimes on other websites. And we hope that people will also consider on the 21st of April something called Global Days of Listening, a chance to listen to the young people from Afghanistan talk about how they want to live in a world without wars.
Where can people get more information?
VCNV.org. That's the website for Voices for Creative Nonviolence. VCNV.org. And if you want to be part of this Skype phone call on the 21st, just spell out Global Days, days plural, Global Days of Listening, .com.
Well, thank you so much for your time and the interview.
Wonderful to be with you, and thank you for all the good questions. My name is Kathy Kelly, and listeners are listening to Rochester Indie Media.